to see you all on Zoom as well. This sermon started as simply be of good courage, because I was thinking about just all the ongoing division that we have in our country, and just questions about how people face things, the future. There are a lot of things we do not know. And we find ourselves on different sides, different places. And so I started with the phrase, be of good courage. And I ended up with be of good courage, lament, pray, wait, do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with our God. So the Hosea passage is what I ended up with last week. And I thought really it's a good passage to keep ahead of us. Now, as I thought of the spaces wherein we need to be of good courage, I just began to look at different stories. And I was drawn to this passage of Hannah because Hannah was in a situation where she was being directly and personally attacked by a close family member. She was being made to feel small. She was being made to feel worthless. She was being verbally abused on a regular basis. And just imagine how she felt or she might have felt as she prepared to go to the temple every year. This was a thing that happened year in and year out. And she saw what she witnessed was that her sister-in-law, or her, not sister, her co-wife, she experienced what was understood as blessing, right? Because she had children. She gave birth. She saw herself as being, or she was infertile. She didn't have children. She was at a loss to understand why. She did know, though, that she, now I'm morphing into our Sunday school, this poverty of spirit this morning. We started a Beatitude series, and we're talking about poverty of spirit. Hannah is one who very definitely had her poverty, in a sense, her need for God pressed on her in this annual basis, because her situation did not change. She came before God. She cried out to God. She lamented before God, but she seemed to not get anywhere. And Eli notices her, assumes that she can't be of any real value. She must be drunk. She's just mumbling. She's lost her mind. I don't know. You get around people who've drank for many years, and they often can speak to themselves for hours on end, mumbling away and so forth, never really coherent. So Eli probably seen more than one person come to the temple and be simply straight babbling before God. But Hannah's there on the ground praying, lamenting her situation and desiring to see God and present her problem before God. And Eli recognizes her. She doesn't accept You know, she's not a person who's weak in the least bit, because she puts her case before God. And when Eli recognizes her, and even when he ridicules her, saying, "You must be a drunk," what's her response? She stands up for herself. She says, "Look, you know, I've got a legitimate gripe with God, for crying out loud." You know? And what's Levi's response? Basically, he says, "Oh, yeah," he doesn't say, "I'm sorry," explicitly. But what he does say is, "Hey, I hear what you're saying." He says, he doesn't say, "I'm sorry," but he expresses a desire to comfort her. And he says, does he say this time next year or not? No, it wasn't in that passage. But he says, "Go in peace. The God of Israel grant the petition you have made to him." So he gives her a blessing in her leaving, and he gives a sort of promise that God will respond. God will act on your prayer. And so Hannah goes, and she says, "Let your servant find favor in your sight." And then she goes home, and she's feeling like a renewed person. She's feeling like the Lord has heard my prayer, and now it's for me to wait and see how God will act. But the thing is, this makes me think about a little bit the whole thing of how, okay, I'll make it practical for right this moment. You know, I've maybe need an occupational therapist or something, I'm not sure. But I've this last several months, I've had this mild hip thing. And, you know, I've been doing this yoga and chair yoga and some other program, and I'm enjoying that a lot. I'm finding it quite helpful. But like last night in bed, you know, about 4 o'clock in the morning, I just could not get comfortable. Even though when I went to bed, I was fine. And I kept, you know, laying there, and I turned my foot a little bit to the left, see if that gives some relief there, or to the right. I pulled my knee up, you know, I you know, held it in different positions to see if the muscles would relax. And I had to keep turning to do that. And I eventually fell back asleep, but then I got up at 5 and went downstairs, and I thought, I need to do some reading and get some things done that I didn't get done yesterday. And lo and behold, I found relief. And, you know, much of the time, or many times, I have heard people who were focusing on their pain, focusing on their discomfort, and heard the illustration or whatever, that often when we're, if we look at our lives like this, and you say, this is our life, you know, your pain might be this, you know, the scale. What's on a scale of 1 to 10, where would you, you know, put your pain? Well, it's at 8. Or is it at 10? 10 is more than I can handle, you know. So put it on a scale of 1 to 10. Well, the thing is, a lot of the times in the process, it's what, in working with pain management, what people try to do, or therapists will try to do, is help reduce the space that the pain occupies in your mind. You know what I'm saying? So, in other words, instead of fixating on the pain, one reduces the preoccupation. In other words, gets distraction to not focus on the pain. And that's not to not take the pain seriously, but it is to reposition the pain, right? So once I started reading and thinking about other things, I was no longer preoccupied by my hip. And even walking down the stairs, I felt a little bit off balance, you know, because I was a bit hesitant to put, you know, I was feeling like it's a little bit unpredictable. But even by the time I got to the bottom of the stairs, I'd forgotten about it because I was walking. And so it's kind of, for me, this thing with Hannah here is she got the kind of, she supplemented, she poured herself out before God. And all it took was a bit of a promise that I've heard you, I've recognized you, God will respond. You know? And to me, that's sort of like how I felt this morning, in that I don't need any kind of emergency something or other, but don't focus on this discomfort. Just let it go. Now, I don't want to be superficial about that, but anyway, for me this morning, unintentionally, I experienced that. When we get to Psalm 27, you know, it's again one of David's, you know, David's this guy who was in all kinds of conflict. His life was full of conflict. And he becomes king, and he's engaged in a great deal of conflict. And this particular psalm, he's crying out to God, saying, "Don't give me up to the will of my adversaries, for false witnesses have risen against me, and they are breathing out violence." So picture him. How do you see David? Is this him being tormented in bed, or is he pacing about somewhere? I'm not sure. But anyway, what he goes back to is what he believes and what his experience of God has been in the past. "I believe that I shall see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait for the Lord. Be strong and let your heart take courage. Wait for the Lord." So, again, so often we are so focused on our immediate pain and discomfort, our immediate situation, where it seems like everything around us is falling apart. And the reminder here in Psalm 27 is, yeah, in spite of the fact that everything feels like it's falling apart, I'm not going to be dismayed, because my faith is in the God who is creator, master of the universe, and I can put my faith in that. And God, I will see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. I can wait for the Lord. In the next passage, it's quite similar, but it's sort of a, in the 27 and in 1 Samuel, in both situations, it's kind of an immediate personal feeling. Whereas when you get to to the next one in 31, it's more of a broader scale. It's sort of a broader scale. Blessed be the Lord, for he has wondrously shown his steadfast love to me when I was beset as a city under siege. The image there is, what's a city under siege look like? Gaza? Gaza is a territory. Yeah. Ukrainian cities. In modern warfare, it's not physically surrounded quite in the same way. And they're being besieged by bombs. They're being attacked on the left and the right. Their supply routes are being cut off. So, you know, that's how ancient warfare was, and it still is that way in some ways. But David sees himself as a person, but his experience of what's happening right now is as though I were a city surrounded by my adversaries and attacking. I don't know if any of you have had dreams like that before, but 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, we were in New Jersey, my sibling get together, and we were planning on driving home back to Richmond along the coast and come through the tunnels up here, you know? And I had this horrific dream. And we were driving, and I went over the bridge and to go get ready to go into the first tunnel. And we're going down, and it turns out it's a glass tunnel. And then it turns out that the tunnel is moving. You know, it turns out the tunnel is moving. And not that it's short gaps, but it's like it's going to be 16 miles in this water that's turning like a serpent. I seriously did not sleep well. I felt like a city under siege. I felt like the moorings that hold me in place, the amount, you know, I, as much as I may not seem to, I don't know what you think, but I like control. I don't need it in the immediate, but I like to know what's happening next 2 years. You know, I like to think a year and a half in advance and so forth to plan. I like to revise the plan and so forth. I need to. I'm not obsessed with the plan, but at the same time, I like to know that in a general sense, I'm going the right way. And so when that tunnel was just flopping around like crazy, and I'm supposed to just stay driving, that was a horrific nightmare. And I woke up quite troubled. And we decided not to go that way home. But then we did the next year. So I got over it. But the point of it was, for whatever reason, that tunnel became an analogy for what was going on in my life. And part of the thing is, at that time, Mission Network had not named any replacement for me, didn't seem to be acting in a good direction or even naming a process. And they knew that in less than a year's time, I was planning to be gone, you know, to resign. And I think that what happened was that I felt like the place I was working rather than walking with me or really whatever, they were the source of my greatest anxiety. And so, in a sense, I had no choice other than to cry out to God and to say, you know, I'm waiting on you, not because I want to wait, but because there's nothing else I can do. I've already done all I can do to get this organization to act, and they're not acting. And so, you know, I was in this situation where I felt like I was trapped and not having any control over outcomes. So we've got the personal situation with Hannah. We've got David in a situation as well where he seemed to feel like it was personal. Here now, he's in a situation where it's the metaphor he uses isn't so much a personal one as that he is like this city that's being attacked by adversaries. And he said, I set an alarm. I am driven far from your sight, but you heard my supplication when I cried out for you for help. Love the Lord, all you his saints. The Lord preserves the faithful, but abundantly repays the one who acts haughtily. Be strong and let your heart take courage, all who wait on the Lord. So the response that David gives is not that we're necessarily going to see any kind of immediate turnaround or change in our situation, but our fear and our sense of the situation being out of control is to push us to trust further in God and wait. Wait on the Lord. Don't fabricate. I've stopped listening to the news right now, even though I'm not very good at not listening. But part of the thing is that it's speculation upon speculation upon speculation about situations we don't know. You know? And it's not helpful. It just fuels anxiety. And, you know, a headline the other day was, or yesterday, I don't know, was about the honeymoon is over with the financial market. Honeymoon. You know, things went up really quickly for 2 days or whatever, and now they're crashing back down. You know? That's not a honeymoon, is it? Less than 48 hours? I mean, so they were saying that in response to the election outcome, there was an increased sense of stability in the market, but that didn't last very long. Well, it's not helpful. It's not helpful to be listening to news that just provokes anxiety for you. You know, years ago, I was seeing a therapist regularly, and I told him, "I'm angry by the time I get out of bed." And he said, why? I said, well, because my alarm's the news, you know, NPR, you know. And so I'm laying there in bed and I hear the news. I hear about this situation and I hear about this situation. And by the time I got out of bed, I would just be angry. I'd be really upset. And he said, what did he say? Yeah, simple idea. Simple idea. Turn off the news. Start with music. Yeah, that's what I do. I have this lovely little lilting thing that starts now. What's that? Yeah, there you go. Listening to the even classical. Is that the Classical channel. Yeah, I have that on in the office. So we, rather than let ourselves be drawn into and controlled by this fear, what does the word say? The word says, we know who God is. We know that we can place our trust in God. We're invited, yes, to bring our lament, to bring all of our worries. We don't have to shelve our worries. There's nothing that God has not seen or heard or experienced. And we can, we don't, I grew up with some of the people that I was in church with who didn't think it was right ever to express anger or disappointment with God. And you hear songs all the time, I've never been disappointed. Well, I've been disappointed a lot. I've been disappointed not only by God, but by myself, by family, by work situations, all kinds of stuff. And God, I've never heard or felt or experienced God as saying, Steve, those emotions are illegitimate. No, I don't agree with that, the sentiment that you can't express your heartfelt grievances with God. The thing is, though, we place those grievances before God so that, Dorothy, when I'm getting out of control, she says, breathe. And she goes like this, you know what this is for? Yeah, it's the old aura stuff, It's sort of, it's disturbing the breeze around you in a sense that breaks it up and lets you get some new air, in a sense. But the point of it is that we, how do we, I'm sorry, how do we take courage? We take courage by actually expressing our lament and expressing and praying. And it's in doing that that we find our courage to carry on, and we can begin to express how God has been faithful in the past and we believe will be faithful in the future. So after looking at this, like I said at the outset, I was really thinking about how do we be of good courage? And after saying lament, pray, wait, actually, Pat had suggested, I'm sorry, I didn't ask permission on this, but Pat had suggested a subtitle as Be of Good Courage, and then something about a little luck. Something, I forget exactly. It was a good phrase anyway. But anyway, what I was working on was how the connection between the term courage and the French encourage or courage, and courage is related to the word heart. The root in Latin is heart. Well, I was going to go that way, but then when I looked it up in Greek and Hebrew, it's completely different. It doesn't have the same connection. So I left it alone. But then what did I replace it with? I came back to the bedrock for me when it comes to how can I know if I'm walking in the right direction, in the right way? Well, it goes back to Hosea 6. What does the God ask of us? What does God ask of us? With what shall I come before the Lord, and how am I bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams and 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit for my body, for the sin of my soul?" You know, he's laying out all of the Levitical law and so forth. He's saying, do I have to do that? But then no, it says this. It says, "He has told you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? But to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God." I would say we're always safe. We're always safe if we come back to that. We can, whatever the situation is of conflict or a sense of being aggressed or whatever, if we come back to it and we say, okay, I'm called to do justice, what does justice look like in this situation? I'm also called to act out of kindness and not return anger for anger. And then it says, walk humbly with God. And in our passages last week with and a couple, 3 weeks ago with Barnabas, it was in those different cases, the person gives away all that he has and immediately follows Jesus. Barnabas receives his sight and he immediately follows Jesus. So walking humbly with our God, walking with Jesus, is what we're invited to do. And so we don't have to be preoccupied or overcome by, one, the triumphalism of having the person that we wanted elected, nor do we have to be overcome by the dismay of not winning. We don't have to be overcome either way. What we need to focus on is what the Lord requires, and that is do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with God. Let's say a word of prayer.
Excuse me.
Thank you, Lord, for this time together, for the many ways that you have provided for our needs, for the blessing it is to be alive, and for this beautiful day that you've given us. We thank you for your word, which gives us comfort and direction no matter where we find ourselves. Help us to be kind, help us to focus on justice, and help us to walk in your way. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.